Tomorrow is a notable day in financial history, the 79th anniversary of Black Thursday. That was the day in 1929 when the stock market began its infamous collapse. The Great Depression was soon to follow. Today, in the midst of economic uncertainty, many call to mind the Great Depression and wonder if a similar fate awaits us now. If that's your worry, give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. You can also reach us by email, talk@npr.org. Jason Zweig is an investment columnist at the Wall Street Journal. He says another Great Depression is unlikely, at least right now. He joins us from the studios of the CBC in New York City. Nice to have you on Talk of the Nation today.
Great to be with you, Neil.
And you were talking not about necessarily Black Thursday, but about a day 2.5 years later when the market hit the bottom.
Yeah, the market hit rock bottom in the summer of 1932, July 9th, 1932, when the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed the day at 41.63, Neil.
You have to remind us where that decimal point is.
The decimal point is after the second digit.
Unbelievable.
The Dow closed at 41.63. It had lost 91% of its value in exactly 3 years. And the total trading volume that day was 235,000 shares. And it was as dark a summer day as Wall Street has ever seen.
And though things seem bleak now, we're a long way away from that.
You know, we're miles away, Neil. And I think people are so upset about the speed at which the wheels have come off the wagon that we do need to put things in perspective. You know, the Great Depression was not called the Great Depression for no reason. I mean, it wasn't just the stock market that was down. The economy was flat on its back. It was very close to dead, actually. Industrial production dropped 52%. Corporate profits dropped 49%. We're nowhere near that scale of catastrophe, not even close.
One of the things you noted in your piece was, in fact, that people no longer wrote checks very much. They would pay off debts, even including rent payments, that sort of thing, in cash.
That's correct. And, you know, we tend to feel, after all the modern convenience of credit cards and ATMs and debit cards, that the troubles we're having in the financial system are unique. But in the wake of the 1929 crash, it was almost impossible for people to use conventional checking accounts because the banks could not actually clear the money. And again, we're nowhere near that scale of trouble.
Just by comparison, the stock market right now, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, 85.29.80, up 5.75 points on the day. So,
And let's put that decimal point where it belongs, Neil. That decimal point is after the fourth digit, not the second.
Well, nevertheless, percentage points, there's been a big drop. There's no doubt about that. And obviously, people are feeling the pain. We heard about the bonfire of the 401ks in the earlier segment, and that's certainly affecting a lot of people dramatically. But yes, it was a great deal worse in 1932. And one of the things that we are told now, I think Warren Buffett is being quoted as saying, you know, when people are greedy, it's time to sell. When times are bad, then it's time to buy. When it was down at 43 points, weren't companies wildly undervalued?
They were. And Warren Buffett's teacher and personal mentor, Benjamin Graham, who was one of the greatest investors Wall Street has ever seen, wrote a series of articles in the summer of 1932 for Forbes magazine, pointing out, as he put it, that America's corporations were now worth more dead than alive. And we've actually reached a point now in the financial markets where many companies now are trading for less than the cash they have on their balance sheets. And many, many more are trading at levels of valuation based on their earnings that they haven't seen in 20 years or more.
But if that's the case, this is just as there was irrational exuberance more than a few years ago, this may be the factor of fear.
It is. And, you know, scientists know quite a bit about the neuroscience of fear. And once investors make the shift from greed to fear, their brains and their bodies work quite differently. And it's almost impossible to tell someone in the grip of panic that instead of yanking your money out of the stock market, you should actually be putting it in because stocks have gotten cheaper. People really don't want to hear that. Emotionally, you can't blame them. But from a logical point of view, you will go broke if you enjoy buying stocks when they're high-priced and all you want to do is sell them when they're low-priced.
We're talking with Jason Zweig, an investment columnist at the Wall Street Journal, about comparisons between the present crisis and the Great Depression that started, tomorrow in 1929. And let's get some callers on the line if you'd like to join us. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. And Amanda's on the line. Amanda's calling us from Arkadelphia in Arkansas.
Yes.
Go ahead, please.
Well, I would just say the fear seems to be the same from when I talked to my grandparents about the issues they had when they were growing up in the Great Depression.
The fear that we were just talking about, and yeah, I think she's right, Jason. So the speed with which this has happened, we talked to some people that, 4 months ago, they seemed to be more or less on track, and then the bottom has just fallen out.
Well, Amanda, I think you're right. I think the levels of fear are extraordinarily high. There have been only a handful of times in financial history when the market has been as volatile as it has been this year, when the market indexes have moved as much as they have. We've had 10% swings in the value of the Dow and the S&P 500 in a single day. And that alone is enough to strike terror into most people. And of course, losing 40% of your money, especially if you're retired, is about as painful a financial experience as you can have. And the approach you should take in response depends on your own situation. If you are retired, it's kind of hard to picture that you would ever want to put more money into the stock market. If you're young, then I would urge you to recognize the fact that something you liked when it was priced at 100 is now priced at 60. And if it was a pair of shoes, you'd say they're on sale.
I'm young and I know I have a chance to recover. My fear is for my parents and my grandmother who is still alive.
Well, Amanda, let's wish us all again good luck in this situation, and we hope that she'll still be telling stories about how bad it was in the old days.
All right. Well, even back then, when the stock market crashed, we didn't expect the Great Depression to be as great as it ended up being.
Well, that's true. The Great Depression, we forget, it dropped out quickly and hit bottom in 1932, but it didn't really start to recover until the Second World War.
Right. Well, thank you very much. You'll have a good afternoon.
You too, Amanda. Appreciate the phone
Bye.
Call. One of the things you do in your piece is quote Professor Robert Shiller at Yale University and Chief Economist for Macro Markets, which he's got a complicated system, an index that he follows that suggests that the price-to-earnings ratio, something people look at pretty closely, is sliding as well, and that he's a guy to take seriously because he was the one who really predicted the collapse of the dot-com bubble and the collapse then of the housing market.
Yeah, Neil, I think it's very important to recognize that this is no time to be a Pollyanna. Things could get worse, and they could get quite a bit worse. I don't think they could get drastically worse. I'm talking about for investors, and there is some conceivable downside left in the market from here. If you believe the worst case scenario, the Dow could go down to something like, 6,000, which would be basically another 25% drop from here. But the upside is also clearly growing by the day each time the market goes down. And if you're a betting person, you have to look both at the downside risk and the upside reward. And the biggest chance to avoid losses is already behind us, and most of the gains probably lie ahead.
Let's get Mike on the line. Mike with us from Charlottesville.
Yes.
Charlottesville, Virginia, I assume?
Yes, that's correct.
Go ahead, please.
personally, I think we have a chance for this as far as its impact on the general public, not the investors who are dealing with things, but the general public that deals with the old Reaganomics trickle-down type of garbage. It's going to trickle down on top of them as a flood, because things have been invested that are critical money, not just spare money. And I was always brought up that you treat the stock market like Vegas. You don't put any money in the stock market you can't afford to lose, just like you don't gamble any money you can't afford to lose.
Right.
We have, in the 20s, we had the situation where more things were done on cash basis, less on credit.
And so people are more exposed because of their credit bills, is what you're suggesting.
People are much more exposed because of credit, and they have much more to lose. Back in the past, when people owned something, they owned it. Chances are it wasn't mortgaged by a credit card where they could be thrown out or have everything attached.
Yeah, well, thus the foreclosure crisis we're seeing today as well.
Yeah, and it's your previous segment involving retirement. I'm convinced that I'll never be able to retire. I'm a small business owner. And the fact that, you know, I will probably not ever be able to retire simply because of the fact that with the way that the government has mismanaged things and allowed this crisis to go, I fear that a Social Security will still be there when I reach retirement age in 20 years.
Well, Jason Zweig, let's leave Social Security aside for right now, but he's right. Credit is people are more exposed than they were in the 1920s.
There's absolutely no doubt about it. You know, Mike, I think you've really put your finger on the thing that should both worry us the most and, I would argue, may give us the most cause for hope. There's no doubt that the worst consequence of this credit bubble of the past 10 years, which was fed largely by Alan Greenspan and aided and abetted by the debt junkies on Wall Street, has led to every level of American society being massively indebted and essentially treating cash like garbage. And you have individuals with credit card bills they'll never be able to pay off. You have institutions with debts they don't even understand. But if I had to make a prediction, it might be that we'll see a backlash. You know, I'm judging by what you said, Mike, you and I are roughly the same age, and you may be able to remember the oil crisis of the 1970s as a teenager, as I do. And I distinctly remember that in 1973, 1974, people simply stopped driving their cars when the price of oil doubled. You know, as recently as last January, when gasoline prices were over $4 a gallon, I would see people pull up to grocery stores in Mercedes-Benz SUVs and go in and leave the motor running. And there's no doubt in my mind that the difference in behavior between 30 years ago and now is driven by the fact that today drivers don't consider the credit that they use to pay for gasoline to be the equivalent of money. Mm-hmm. It's essentially garbage. And they don't mind wasting it.
We're talking about comparisons between 1929 and 2008. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we get another caller on. This is Josh. Josh with us from Madison, Wisconsin.
Yeah, hi.
Go ahead, please.
Well, I'm an undergraduate student. And my first question is, who didn't have fear during the Great Depression? Because you're talking about that now. And as someone who doesn't have fear right now, I'm going to leave college in a year with very little debt. What should I do with my money?
Oh, there's a good question. A man with an I'm seeing the glass half full.
Yeah, oh, definitely.
Well, you got to love it, Josh. I'll give you some examples of people who did not have fear during the Great Depression. Investors with a very long-term view, and Benjamin Graham was one, and he ended up being Warren Buffett's teacher. The investors with a long-term view looked around them and saw great American corporations being valued at less than half the prices they had sold for 2 or 3 years earlier and bought. and held on and made fortunes. There was a man named Floyd Odlum who became one of the richest men in America by buying up depressed industrial and utility stocks during the Great Depression. What should you do with your money if you're young and you feel you have cash and courage, which are the two prerequisites for an investor in this environment? Then you should build a diversified global portfolio of index funds. Put most of your money in stocks using very low-cost index funds that essentially buy and hold every security in the market. You can get a total international stock index fund. You can get a total U.S. market index fund. Put a few thousand dollars in each. Add $100 a month or whatever you can afford. Put it all on autopilot, and 30 or 40 years from now, you will be a very wealthy man.
Well, thank you very much for that inspiration.
And Josh, good
You're
luck
welcome.
To you.
Thank you very much, Neil.
Bye-bye. And thanks for your time today, Jason.
Thank you, Neil. It's great to be with you.
Jason Zweig, an investment columnist at The Wall Street Journal. He joined us from New York City and the studios of the CBC. He's the author of Your Money and Your Brain, How the New Science of Neuroeconomics Can Help Make You Rich. Ira Flatow's here tomorrow with Science Friday. We'll be back on Monday. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.